traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit energycitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.
Welcome to the Contrarian Investor Podcast, where we give voice to those who challenge a prevailing narrative in global financial markets. The podcast is for informational purposes only. Nothing is intended as investment advice. Now, here's your host, Mr. Nathaniel E. Baker.
Our guest today is Peter Borish, the chief strategist at Quad Group here in New York. Peter is probably best known as the founding partner of Tudor Investment Corp, a little hedge fund you may have heard of. Tudor, of course, started by Paul Tudor Jones, one of the oldest and probably most well-known hedge funds out there, period. Peter also has experience. He worked at the Federal Reserve and is a founding board member of Robinhood. So with all his experience and background on Wall Street and as an investor, I thought it would be very interesting to bring Peter onto this podcast and share his views with us. He does so at length in what we're about to listen to. And what he has to say about the economic cycle, I thought was particularly interesting. And perhaps most interesting of all are his comments about active versus passive investing. Passive investing, as we all know, has been something that has gained a lot of traction recently and also a lot of flows when it comes to investor assets. But there are reasons to believe that it is not always the best course. And Peter discusses these at some length in this podcast. So without further ado, let's get into it and let me roll the tape. Here you go.
You know, I think in this environment and, you know, being a big baseball fan and it's the middle of the baseball season, investing to a large extent is a lot like being a baseball manager, which is the art of managing is not that complicated in theory, which is just don't leave your pitcher in there one pitch too many. Okay. You never see the manager come out and say, wow, you've done a great job. I'm going to take you out because I'm concerned about the next pitch. No, you walk out there, you see him take that guy out after he's given up the 3-run homer when you're up by 2 runs and then you're losing the game.
Right.
Investing and what you have to do as an individual or an asset manager is very, very similar. You can't sit there and say, just because this worked, it's going to continue work. That's the contrarian nature of it. So if you look at the current markets, and it doesn't mean whether you should be bullish or bearish, there's one truth in this world, which is math works. So if you look at how the indices are constructed based on cap weighted, it forces everyone to sort of do what's they're not taught to do. You're taught to buy low, sell high. But indices force you to buy higher. The weighting in that index goes up, and if it's short, the weighting goes down. So now you're mismatched. When I say math works, Google, Amazon, Apple, Microsoft, Netflix, these stocks are mathematically impossible to compound at the same rate of speed over the next 10 years that they have over the prior 10 years. Otherwise, they'll be the only stocks in the world. So what does that say? As a contrarian investor, and it has nothing to do with whether they're good or bad companies, your job is to try to see where is the most likelihood of price appreciation. They are not going to be in the same stocks that they have been. You know, if you go back to this sports analogy for a second, if you're building a basketball team for the next 10 years, your first pick isn't LeBron James. He was the best guy for the last 10 years. That's what makes it hard. Every individual investor is sort of like their own general manager.
All right, so then how does one find the next Microsoft, the next Apple, and the next big growth story for the next generation?
First of all, is that your job? Right? If you're an investor, so if you're in venture capital, angel capital, then, you know, that's what you're supposed to do. But you have to realize the failure rate is very high. We all like to talk about our winners. And, you know, that's why I'm a chief strategist. I take credit for the winners. I blame others for the failures.
Yes.
We don't go back here and talk about all those. And I kid around all the time. When I was at Tudor with Paul Jones, and we knew computers were going to change the world. Okay. We're down on our hands and knees, flopping out, upgrading computers, doing all that other stuff. And there's this new company, Microsoft. IBM gave them the software, basically. Remember the old disk operating system? They thought that hardware was the business. Who knew? Apple almost went out of business in the switch from Jobs to Scully. You're not going to hold that. Amazon was down 95%. Went from $100 to $5. So we can look backwards from that positive outcome. But as an individual investor, trying to pick the winners isn't going to work. Think about how well you do as an individual when you're playing Survivor or fantasy football. It's really tough. What edge do you have as an individual investor in selecting those next winners? That's a low probability. So if you're going to be long, then you need to think about sectors, what's out of favor, contrarian investor. And that's the hardest thing. Mm-hmm. It's not human nature to rebalance your portfolio, to sell some winners, to invest in some losers. Of course, after the fact, everybody says you should have done that. After the fact, everything is obvious. Oh, I knew 08 was coming.
So it sounds like maybe finding the right people with the right knowledge might be helpful, which kind of speaks to the whole idea that having an active manager could actually help one's returns, which is actually a contrarian view nowadays. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. So at the beginning of a bull market, everybody wants to be a trader when you should be an investor. And at the end of a bull market, everybody wants to be an investor when you should be more of a trader. Why? Because I'm looking backwards from a positive outcome. The worst thing you can have in a bull market is risk management, because time bails you out. Now, again, it doesn't mean whether you're bearish today and I'm getting short as a trader, or I think it's going up a little bit. We're talking two different things here. And it's like, knock on wood, my dad just turned 92. And I go, Dad, I love you, but I'm not buying a 115 call. You have to plan. Every day, this bull market is one day closer to the end. By definition, it doesn't mean that it's over. You need to plan. So if you continually drive and you're always looking in a rearview mirror, you're going to hit a light pole. That's where this is not an easy business. And it's particularly tricky for the individual, because you can look back. And if you go meet with somebody and says, if I had done this, these would have been my returns.
Sure. Yeah. Hindsight is a beautiful thing.
I'm starting up Hindsight Hedge Fund. You know, where, yeah. Because that means all my trades are winners.
Yeah.
That's the only person we know whose trades are winners are in jail.
Yeah, that's kind of true, actually. So, okay, so you're not going to win every trade. You're not going to win every investment. So, you know, diversifying, is that helpful?
It depends on your personality. So if you're an investor, if you're trading, you have to trade your own personality. What's most helpful is discipline and risk management. And I always, people always say in this business, you know what? If you have a big ego, you can't take losses, and that's how it is. And the reality is the opposite. If you have enough self-confidence and discipline and belief in what you do, you can take that loss. And then you get back in and say, okay, I'm going to make it back, and I'm going to make it back some more. It's the people with the small ego who can admit that they're wrong, let little losses run into big losses. You are constantly wrong in this business. It's very humbling. If you look at returns, and you see that too, because people are really good at number, right? So they're like, hey, be in the market all the time, because if you just miss the best days, you miss all the returns. Of course, they don't do the opposite, which is, you know, if you miss the bad days. So you should be in all the time because you can't time it. Well, if you have a disciplined approach, approach, whether that's to an individual equity, whether that's to a futures contract, and you can maintain that discipline, that's okay. I used to say all the time when I was had my CTA after I left Tudor and it was all automated signals, people are like so concerned about their proprietary signals. And I'm like, I could put them in Times Square because when I'm in a drawdown, no one will follow them.
Right.
They love you on the way up, but if it's not working, you were lucky, mm-hmm. and it's going to break down.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like a lot of this, a lot of the key is to be able to identify what part of the business cycle we're at, right? Because, you know, you can split into quadrants. A lot of people do that. If it's early days of the business cycle, obviously you want to be long growth. You want to. So what do you think of that? That it's just really just a question of identifying where we are in the economic cycle and then choosing our allocations based on that.
Well, of course, economic cycles can go very long period of time. Right. And we often look back and so we want this immediate satisfaction. Oh, I think the cycle's changing. Right. And if it doesn't change tomorrow, it's going to continue. But the reality here is that the, my opinion, the international deflationary forces are growing dramatically. Mm-hmm. We're seeing that. So not, and I always have to define, I'm a Democrat that believes in markets, but to define economic growth. So if we think about the period from when the Berlin Wall came down to President Trump was elected, what did we have? We had a cycle of the free movement of people, capital, and ideas, the breaking down of barriers, which had led to, from that period, based it on the equity market, global growth, quite strong.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we elected, and now what are we doing? We're building barriers.
Mm-hmm.
We're not having the free flow of people, capital, and ideas. And growth is slowing dramatically, not only here, but around the world. So that's why I talk about deflationary pressures. At the same time, we have a record amount of debt. So if you're a central banker and you're seeing yourself, you have to ask, how do I solve a debt crisis? By issuing more debt. And so that becomes the term, you know, of pushing on a string. So for me, when I see this from a macro point of view, I think an interesting trade would be a bear steepening of the yield curve, where you buy the 10-year, you sell the 30-year, particularly now that the administration is thinking of adding to the supply of longer-dated bonds to fund this perpetual deficit. That is going to be a problem. Now, one of the interesting things about going back to the growth of the post-Berlin Wall coming down is in the 90s, we grew dramatically. We were running a surplus until President Bush had his tax cuts. So we, in cycles, in this term, you really have to look back. Now, change didn't happen the day after the Berlin Wall came down.
That's right.
It took a few years for markets to adjust. So right now, things don't change immediately. You have a $20 trillion economy. But if there's been sand in the gears because of this lack of free flow of people, capital, and ideas, it's going to slow down. And we're seeing that in the recent data. So now's the hard part for the investor. Well, I see all this, I know what you're saying, so forth and so on, but the stock market's still near its highs. And then that becomes the behavioral difficult part, right? I define a quandary. What's the definition of a quandary? Do I stay out of a market and watch everyone else make money? Or do I get in and thereby cause it to immediately crash?
Right, right. Well, that's the whole Robert Shiller thing about, you know, the peak of cycles and of, you know, the euphoria and all these other things. That's kind of the definition of a bubble, is you don't necessarily believe the fundamentals, but you see other people getting rich and you want to, you don't want to miss it. But going back to your point about these
and
barriers.
Dr. Schiller, by the way, I'm a big Michigan guy. He went to Michigan. Yes, so we'll, I'm going to support him for that.
All right. I mean, you have to ask offline when you think about Jim Harbaugh, but another topic. But okay, so let's go back to this. These barriers coming up now. You know, what do you make of the argument, or do do you not think there's any merit to it, that Trump could be voted out of office and the barriers could come down again? Because a lot of this is not by legislation, it's by presidential decree that he's done, you know, tariffs. So that could easily, just a new administration could easily, maybe not if it's Elizabeth Warren, but a new administration could easily just undo a lot of the barriers that he's just erected, couldn't they?
If you've ever taken apart something, it's a lot easier to take it apart than put it back together.
Right.
Or we can always go back to Humpty Dumpty, right? Once he fell. So it's easy to put sand in the gears. It takes far longer to clean the gears out. So that's where we are. I think there's a reasonable probability that, I don't know if he'll be impeached by the House, whether he's convicted by the Senate, but I think there's a reasonable probability that he'll decide not to run again for a host of reasons. But even if that's the case, the gunking up of the gears of the economy, it's going to take longer than the consensus, at least in our opinion, is to move that. So growth is going to be slow. Of course, the level in which everyone needs to take a look at is the S&P. Now, we're here at, you know, whatever it is, 2950, 2960. If we're below 2720, right, the March and June lows, that to me would be quite critical. That's not that far away, but it's far enough away. So from a trading point of view, more money is lost anticipating something happening rather than being patient and waiting for it to happen. And that's really, really difficult. And I tell all our guys, not trading is a trade. So if you're looking for the long run, now this is different. If I've got a 401k or a 403b or I've got my pension, then yeah, it's in, depending on where your time frame is and what you're there, the tricky part is what do you do? So I'm going to throw out a little math question here for all your contrarian listeners. So I start my career at age 22. I'm going to work 50 years. If I make and I put in $100, if I work 50 years and it goes up 7%, at the end of those 50 years, I have $3,200.
Right.
The rule of 10.
Sure.
So the question is, if in year 51, I lose 50%, I have an 08, so now I'm down to 1,600. And this becomes the difficulty for people looking backwards from a positive outcome. What is my compounded annual return over that period of time? I started at 100 and now I'm at 1,600. Right. 50 years later. So you've gone from 3,200 to 16 in 1 year. I'm going to just tell you the answer.
People. Yeah, tell me, because I'm not good at math.
So many people think, oh, it goes to 3.5, right?
Because I knew that much, yeah.
It's not anywhere near that. So if I said to you, this number is going to be close to 5.9. So if I said, hey, I got a 5.9 return over 50 years, that's pretty good. So it's the timing of the volatility and the drawdown. So the longer you're there, and then at the end of the cycle, if you have that big drawdown, it doesn't whack your compounded returns. So you need to think about this. It's the other issue too. If I'm expecting, and this is where, you know, people come back and they're looking backwards from a positive outcome, I'm expecting this compounding. So now all of a sudden it's year 10. So I've gone from 100 to 200 based on 7. Then I'm down, I lose 50% that one bad year. Now I'm at 50. And then I go back on 7% forever. I never catch up. And every year that spread gets wider and wider and wider. Why? Right? Because I'm compounding on a higher base in the first case. So math matters. The illusion of the return is important. And that's why I try to explain to people, volatility and risk management is extremely important, and you want to try to keep your losses small if you can, because that averaging down works great, but the one time when it doesn't work, you're in huge trouble. This is our business, and we believe that, you know, more active managers, that we look for alpha generating capacity constrained strategies, is going to be relevant here. And an individual should look for some of those as well. So if you're with an RIA, your RIA should diversify you by investing in strategies like us or looking at some of the other alternative ETFs. Now, the hard part is they're going to say, well, why are you putting my money in that? It hasn't done so well, which is weird because, again, going back to the sports analogy, these are all the same people that love the backup quarterback.
Mm-hmm.
Right? The backup quarterback's always the most favored player on the team because he hasn't made mistakes yet.
Right.
So this disconnect between, you know, and that's where I want people to sort of focus. It's not that different. It's also why I'm not, like, super bullish on the all the robo business, because there's an emotion attached to money. It's okay when you're making it. But when things, you're not making it, and we see that, like when the Dow is down 800 points, which is nothing given the levels that we're at, it becomes a lead story.
Yeah.
The story should be, if the Dow is down 3,500 points in a day, now you're talking about a significant percentage that should get people's attention. But 800, it's just noise.
All right, here's a question for you. You've selected managers. You met with many, many managers. Obviously more on the hedge fund side. What would you say to somebody who is choosing an RIA, right? Or a wealth advisor or what have you? Is there anything to look out for? How do you know if you have somebody who's good?
Well, those are two questions. The difference, meaning managers versus RIAs. RIA. Okay. On the RIA side, the inclination is to sort of, you know, do business with somebody you like and, and your buddy and so forth and so on, which is okay because you want to do business with people you like, but you really need to see what are they doing to earn their fee. If all they're doing is sort of, well, I've got, you know, I'm long the S&P or NASDAQ or whatever, or I have some international ETF and then I've got some TLT, you know, as a hedger. Okay, they're not doing stuff that's sophisticated, that's sort of worked before. Are they doing something? Are they taking some small risk, like diversifying into some sort of alternative, whether it's alternative ETF or an alternative like us, to justify the fee and the stress that they're in there, admit that something may not work. In terms of a manager, when we look at managers, and this is the interesting thing, right? The first line of every disclosure document is past results are not indicative of future performance, but everybody looks at past results. What I tend to focus on is we need real-time data. And I know that returns are not really forecastable, but the volatility of those returns are more forecastable. That's a reflection, if it's a model based, of what the model is, or if it's an individual, what that personality is of the individual. So we want to see the path to growth, what that volatility is. So can we go through a period where they're sort of flat and not making any money, but understand their volatility? Because, yes, strategies come in cycle, they come at a cycle. That's why you have a diversified portfolio. So we're really concerned about that risk associated with that. And we look at that. And we also have the same rule. We want to do business with people we like. And then hopefully they're doing something different, right? The one thing, do we need another day trading S&P guy, gal in what we do? Probably not, right? There's a lot of those. So if you're doing something unique and there's an approach to it. But you see buzzwords all the time. So, oh, we had all these volatility sellers. Those strategies change. So where we are, as being, you know, sort of the manager of the managers, is you have to be on top of that all the time. Now, investors, myself and the other partners, take the netting risk. So that's all the more reason that we want lower volatility strategies. I've never met a manager that says, hey, I'm up 10%, don't pay me until some person I never met before gets back to even. If you want to be that first one, I'm all in favor.
Okay. So are there any strategies that you would, that you typically, you guys typically rule out? Any asset class or anything like that?
Well, we look at, because we want to provide liquidity to all our investors, so we only trade level one products. So that's long, short equity, futures, and options.
Right. Okay.
So we're not doing credit or, you know, cash, fixed income, etc. We're not trying to pretend that we're going to do early stage, you know, private equity and value. No. We want to stick with what our knitting is, which is hopefully identifying alpha generating capacity constrained strategies.
Is there still a good supply of managers that can do this, especially in the equity space? Because all you hear about is how the hedge fund industry has been kind of, you know, decimated, and the returns aren't there, the fees are too high, blah, blah, blah. But there is still talent out there that you guys are still
well doing. I tell everybody, I spend a lot of my time looking at bad numbers. Now we want the smaller people, and the bigger guys always want, you know, the $100 million person. By definition, that supply is pretty constrained,
right?
And so there's a quality issue there. We're trying to move down in terms of what they do, 25 million, etc. So there's a much larger supply of those. But again, it's kind of like, you know, every 13-year-old kid thinks they're going to be playing in the NBA.
Right.
Don't tell me you bought Google and you're a hedge fund manager.
Right.
So you got to figure it out. Our job is to figure it out. Are you doing something differently? Or is it just the same and, you know, you benefited from this bull market?
Yeah.
So it's an art and a science, but in our case, we think, you know, it's a human capital business, which is partially my responsibility of identifying that talent. And again, going back to the sports analogy, why are some teams always good and some teams always bad? Everybody has access to the same analytical tools. Everybody has access to the same players. It's not like somebody, you know, has been stuck in the desert for 20 years and then they bring them out and they're sprung on the NBA. So it starts with leadership and the organization, and our partners are there, and we try to put people in an environment, in a culture where they can succeed.
All right, let's go back to the big picture here economically. Is there anything that scares you in today's markets, in the economy, even politically, if you want to go there? Although it's obviously not a political show, but what do you think?
So it's difficult to sort of segment, you know, on a macro basis, policy, politics, and markets. I'll just reiterate what I just said with regard to quality of the leadership, which is concerning from a macro point of view. But we're, by definition, as I said earlier, we're sort of at the tail end of the historical length of a bull market. We see that the market itself is unchanged basically since January of 18 after the you know, tax cuts went into effect. Growth has slowed. Most forward-looking indicators, ISM, Michigan Sentiment, etc., have declined, and you're seeing a drag of the economies around the world, never mind the added uncertainty that has taken place with, at best, let's just say, extraordinarily OPEC economic policies. So yes, I'm concerned, but at the end of the day, the market is right and I'm wrong. That's what we take your temperature on every day. So as I said, as long as the S&Ps are here, it's okay. Now, think about it. FedEx, big company.
Right.
It's back below where it was before President Trump took office. Let's look at Caterpillar, 3M. So from an individual point of view, it probably the market is reinforcing sort of bad behavior, which is just shove into the indices because picking these individual stocks is too difficult. We think that's an opportunity for us in sort of the more active space. As you've seen, there's opportunities there, both on the long and the short side.
Yeah, part of the reason this show exists.
But if the market and the S&Ps take out the levels that we've discussed, then I think there's a good chance. I thought it could be by now, but later fourth quarter growth this year could be close to zero. First quarter growth next year might even be be negative because of what you're seeing around
mm-hmm.
the world.
Mm-hmm. And then you don't have much further to go for technical recession, right? Two consecutive quarters of negative.
That's correct.
Yeah. Do you have any thoughts on what could tip it off? Are there any parts of the market that you think are a little bit over-levered, more over-levered than others? Like, yeah.
Well, I, if you want to be a student of history and we think about the stocks that led, and so the intersection of technology and policy, we saw in, for example, at the highs in 69, the government going after IBM.
Mm-hmm.
We saw the situation, obviously, in 2000, going after Microsoft. So these large stocks, which are sort of in engine, you know, endearing sort of monopoly behavior,
mm-hmm.
and then government policy going to affect them, tends to be happen at inflection points.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm looking at that very closely.
Mm-hmm.
And if they turn, then everything else is going to turn with them. Remember,
mm-hmm.
the fourth quarter last year, stock market is down
yeah.
over 20%. But because it came roaring back in the first quarter, people tended to forget that.
Mm-hmm.
But if I was going to end, I would say never minimize the pain when looking backwards from a positive outcome.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Because that's the lack of risk management. Oh, well, it wasn't so painful because we're back at new high grounds. But
mm-hmm.
when you're living in the middle of it,
yeah.
you don't know if that's going to happen. That's why you have to have a discipline and a game plan ahead of time.
Peter Boris, thank you so much for joining me here on the Contrarian Investor Pod. Maybe just a last note on where people can find you. The website?
www.quadgroup.com.
Quadgroup.com.
Obviously, okay. If you're interested in any lack of insights, I've got a Twitter handle at
That's right, you do.
P. Boris.
Yeah.
And yeah.
Cool. Very good. Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Peter, and thank you all for listening, and we look forward to speaking to you again next time.
This concludes our podcast episode for today. We thank you for listening. Remember to subscribe to the podcast, follow us on social media, and get in touch with any questions or concerns at PodContrarian on Twitter, ContrarianPod on Instagram, or email contrarianpod@gmail.com. We look forward to speaking to you again next week.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org, paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.